What's going on, everybody? This is Zach Myers, and you are checking out The Jeremy White Show.
The stars live here.
Are you ready?
On air.
Are you
ready? Online.
Are you ready to have a good time?
On your smart speaker and wherever you stream. Broadcasting from Montreal and around the world.
The Jeremy White Show, available wherever you stream.
Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now.
Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
Our next guest is a guitar player from one of my personal favorite bands. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Just really excited to be talking to Zach. Of course, let's just throw this out there. For the last two decades, 21 number one active rock hits, 15 platinum and gold singles, platinum and gold certifications for all the records, billions of streams worldwide, not to be bowing down to the king right now, but let's just throw this out there. Pretty much the biggest band in the history of rock radio. It's kind of weird to be saying that. I mean, is it weird to hear that?
It's weird to hear, and it's weird to have to say it, like, when I do stuff. And also, I'd like to not, I'm going to make it worse right now. It's 23 number ones.
23? We got to update the press release. Their latest record is called Planet Zero. You pick it up now wherever you get your music, and specifically on this clear vinyl, which is awesome, and a symptom of being human, blowing up all over again. So we're going to talk all about this. Welcome to the show for the first time, the one, the only, Zach Myers from Shinedown.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Is it weird that your song now, like a year later, if the music video comes out and everything, like Z100's playing it of all stations?
It's weird that, yeah, I mean, it's weird because it's happened twice now with us where like we release a single and then it keeps just kind of, it never goes away. And then a year later, it crosses over, you know, that's what Second Chance did, you know, is right. That thing where it's like, you know, you release it to one format and it goes, and then you release it to the next format and it goes, and you release it to the next format and it goes. It's very strange, to especially this day and age, to have a single have that much life. You know, usually, like, right, especially like back in the day when we'd get a number one on rock, it'd sit there for 12 weeks. And now the needle moves so much. It's like usually like this one held at 4 weeks, which I couldn't believe. And then usually it's like most rock bands, if they get a number one, they got it for a week and then it shuffles around, you know?
Yeah. Well, especially with people's, like, you know, attention span these days, it's like, you know, a band puts out a single, oh, and the next week there's a whole new cycle. You're like, okay, what's new this week?
100%. Absolutely.
So, I mean, because it's funny, like, you know, a couple of years ago, I was actually auditioning to be on Z100. And, like, this was at the time when, like the music on the station was, like, you know, Major Lazer and Moe and Justin Bieber and Ed Sheeran. Like, you would have never heard any type of distorted rock guitar or anything like that on Z100. But now here we are in 2024, and it's kind of like tastes are changing. Like, CHRs aren't afraid of guitars again.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, it's not like it's a heavy rock song or
but
anything.
But still, you're like the rock
but still,
band.
You don't hear really, you really don't hear guitars on top 40 radio anymore. That's, I don't know if you've heard one since Second Chance, honestly, but that's a real one anyway.
Well, I mean, unless it's like, you know, processed, you know, jangly, clean guitar tones, like you're
Or like a weird, you know, like a solo, like a weird solo thing, like maybe a Bruno Mars thing or something like that. But it's definitely strange that, you know, I think all formats though kind of sway and move a little bit. You know, I when I hear the word alternative radio now, I'm still not thinking, you know, whatever Tame Impala or Phoenix or all these bands that are, I don't really know any songs from. I'm not saying that. That's just not what I really listen to.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't really listen to rock music either. So, but like when I think of alternative music, like to me, I'm still in like, oh, that's Smashing Pumpkins, that's Soundgarden, that's Nirvana, that's, you know, the Pixies, that's, you know, Mudhoney, you know? So like, it's weird for me. Like, I think all formats though have a little bit of an ebb and flow with it, and I think every once in a while, like a song like this kind of sneaks in, and it's doing it right now. I can't believe it. You know, I'm honored to that we can write songs that can still do that.
How awesome is Mudhoney, by the way?
Love Mudhoney, man. One of the most underrated kind of Seattle bands, I think.
Yeah, saw them a couple of years ago at the Ritz PDV in Montreal, and Mark Arm is just like, oh god, like on fire. Just
Mudhoney's great, man. Underrated band for sure.
Talk a little bit about A Symptom of Being Human. Of course, the music video, just like, you know, it's blowing back up and everything, but I'm sure you've told the story 1,000 times and Brent's told us a story too. But from your perspective, I mean, going in and producing the song and being a part of it from the beginning, it's like seeing it take this life that it's taking on. I mean, it must be really fulfilling.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we knew when we wrote that song, it was something kind of like Daylight. When we wrote Daylight, it was like, all right, this is, there's something going on here. And, you know, when you listen to your own song and you find yourself getting emotional about the subject matter and the feeling that it gives you, and then you go out and you play that song the first time for people and you see them kind of like doing the same thing, like getting teary eyed and, you know, play that song.
Yeah.
Over 150 times at this point. And to see people in the crowd crying, and like, I always try to like get in there with them and like, and feel what they're feeling. And I've definitely not hidden my emotions playing that song on stage. You know, it's a big song, and it makes people feel a lot, which is, you know, that's what you want any song to do. I'm one of those people that, you know, when I'm sad, wants to listen to sad songs. So I don't want to listen to like Jimmy Eat World when I'm depressed, you know. No. Like I don't want to listen to Jimmy Eat World like when I feel good.
Yeah, I'm feeling shit. I'm taking a drive and listening to It Only Hurts When I Breathe by Shania Twain. Like,
yeah. Lucero.
But it's, you know, it must be weird though, because like every songwriter I talk to, it's like you never know whether or not like somebody's going to relate to something that you're personally going through. It's like, how do you even like connect with like the masses in a sense? And you never know what's going to click with people.
I think you write about what you're going through, and you kind of hope that somebody can connect with that. I think I don't feel like personally, like I feel like music is so universal, mm-hmm. that, you know, someone's gone through this. And also like we're not big fans of like reinterpreting. Like we've never really tell people what a song's about. We'll kind of bounce around it, but like, you know, I'm a huge John Prine fan, like one of my favorite songs ever. And like, there's so many of his songs that like touch me in a different way that, you know, it's funny, man. My son, one of my sons is 7 and he's really getting into music, and he's insanely smart. And the other day we were listening to like Zach Bryan or something, and he was like, what's this song about? And I was like, well, you know, I go, I don't really know. I go, I can tell you what I think it's about. I go, but that's kind of the great part about music. I said, told him, I was like, you know, you can go, what do you think it's about? And he would tell me, and I go, okay, well then that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't like telling people what our song's about, because like, you know, again, I'm a big John Prine fan. So if mm-hmm. I think of this song as like a really deep, meaningful song, and knowing John Prine being a very weird guy, and he's like, no, this is a song about a burrito that I mm-hmm. ate in 1978.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I don't want to hear that. I don't need to know what a song's about. There's definitely been songs that I'm curious about that I've wondered what they're about. But like, I don't need to know what a song's about. I'd rather just kind of make up my own meaning.
Yeah. It's always open to interpretation. I mean, like, you could take a song. It's funny. Like a couple of years ago, Harry Styles put out Watermelon Sugar, and everybody's like, oh, I wonder what he's singing about. And he's like, I'm singing about pussy. Like,
yeah. This is what this is about. Yeah. Break it down to the simplest thing that you can break it down to.
Yeah, that's it. I really love the fact that you have the off-white guitar. I remember watching your rig rundown maybe like a year ago, and I ended up wearing this, like, very ironically, didn't even plan it at all, and I just remembered this. Talk a little bit about that.
First thing I noticed.
Your love of fashion, of course, love of shoes and everything, but like, talk specifically about the guitar. I mean, like, it's weird because a lot of rock and roll artists over the years have been highly influential in the fashion sense, but you look at rock guys today, and it's like, you know, when the 90s sort of hit, it was the grunge movement. I mean, they all started dressing like techs on stage as opposed to the rock stars, and it never really recovered from that. Talk a little bit about, you know, how important the fashion is to you.
I mean, I love art. So to me, fashion is art, just like guitars are art, just like sneakers, you know. And I think that, and I'm also a big fan of simplicity. And when I met Virgil the first time, I really took to him and thought he was an amazing human being. And then when he got the Louis Vuitton gig as the head of men's design and moved on, just a great guy, man. And it's so sad what happened to him, and, you know, getting cancer. But when the guitar was really cool, because I met him, I've been signed to Jordan since 2016, which has been great and led to us obviously creating our own Shinedown shoe, which was highly, highly, highly coveted. But I got his email and his number, and I sent him an email trying to do it like the official way. And then like, I never heard anything back. And then I sent him a text. It was like, hey man, I sent you an email, which is like the, you know, that's like the stalker girl, you know? And I said, I would, you know, I would love to for you to design this guitar for me. I don't need you to paint it. I don't need you to make it. Just give me a design idea. Mm-hmm. And I didn't hear back from him for, 8 months maybe. And I was like, well. And I was told him, I was like, hey, man, I know like what you are. And I know your art is worth, I believe in art being worth money. So like, you tell me what you need and I'll pay it. And like in my head, I was legitimately thinking $10,000 or whatever, which would have been fine. I got the guitar for free from PRS. So, man, about 8 months later, he goes, dude, I don't know how I missed this. He goes, I did see your text. He goes, I thought I texted you back. He goes, but here you go. And he sent me two different ones. And one was really busy. Mm-hmm. And it was like every knob said knob and like switch and like all these different things. And I was like, and then he said, then I didn't see it at first, but he sent me a second one that was just simple. And it literally just said guitar. And then it said switch. And then like, that was like in the back said Off-White courtesy of Zach Myers, PRS guitars. And I was like, wow. And then he sent me some orange. He didn't have any regular tags. So he sent me the orange Nike tags. And that's what I put on the headstock. I mean, I think fashion is like, I mean, you look back to bands like All American Rejects did their own shoe. Run DMC did their own shoe. Glassjaw had a dunk, I believe, that is impossible to find. I've tried to find it several times. I think fashion plays a huge role. That's kind of why I like bands like Måneskin or however you pronounce their name. Like I think, you know, I would never wear that stuff on stage, but man, like I love how fashionable they are and like how they push boundaries. Like I'm super into that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, even bands like the Struts, I mean, they got the Ray Brown stuff out on stage these days. It's freaking awesome.
One of my favorite, dude, some of my favorite people on this earth, one of my favorite bands we've ever toured with. We brought them out to open for us a couple times. Just the coolest dudes in the room, no matter what room they go in, dude. Yeah. They're the cool. Like, I actually have a funny story about this. We were just, I just did a cruise with them, the Rock Boat cruise, like a couple weeks ago.
Nice.
Hanging out with them, and Luke came up to me one morning. We were doing a meet and greet, and it was terribly early, and he was awfully hungover. Like, I have a photo of him where he's like in a robe. He's in one of the robes from the boat. I go, man, I go, wait, what is that cologne you're wearing? Like, you smell amazing. And I'm going to do a horrible British accent right now, but I couldn't understand what he was saying because it was early in the morning. He had probably had about 2 hours of sleep. He's like, hombre leva. And I was like, what? Hombre leva. And I was like, oh, okay. And I didn't want to ask him like a third time. So like, I literally like go back to my meet and greet table. I'm meeting people, like in between meeting people, I'm looking up hombre leva. And I'm like, nothing's coming up, obviously.
Right.
And then I realized it says Ombre Leather, which is a Tom Ford cologne, which I now own because of Luke Spillett from the Struts.
I thought he was going to say something like, oh, I'm wearing Jack Daniels too.
Dude, well, here's the thing. I will say, I think it smelled better on him than me, probably because it was mixed with whiskey and cigarettes. But it smelled really good.
Whiskey and cigarettes. That's a good mixtape name.
Yeah, man.
So much fun. Symptom of Being Human. You got to check it out. Music video. Check out the latest record, man. I saw you guys last time you played in Montreal. You did that makeup show. It was supposed to be like a small thing. And then you brought your whole arena production into the Olympia Theater, which I wasn't expecting. Yeah. Because I got into the crowd. I'm like, okay, what's going on? There's like screens. And all, when the pyre went off, I'm like, these guys are going to burn this freaking club down. The live show for you guys, obviously super important. But I would have never thought that a band like at your level would have went so out of your way for your fans that night to bring in the arena production into a small club like that.
I mean, for us, like, I don't know. I feel like the production has become such a part of who we are in the sense of like, yeah, I don't know. Like for me, I've been designing our production now since 2016, where I kind of like, you know, want to like do this thing where we like, I want to make everything memorable, you know? And like, so to me, I saw it, I believe that was July of 22 that we did that. And I saw it on the thing and I knew it was a smaller place and it wasn't a arena because we had just done Place Bell, I think, in Quebec.
Yeah, in Place Bell.
And I was like, this is what I want to do. You know, I want to bring a big show in there. And we did, and it was maybe a little too much, but it was, you know, for me, production is what you remember. Like or who knows me knows that like on days off from tour, like I go to shows, like I get on Polestar before the tour starts, like 2 days before the tour starts. And I'm like, all right, we have a day off here, 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 here. And I check those cities on those days to see what shows are there. One of the main reasons I do that is obviously that I love music, but I enjoy going to see other bands' productions. And like, you know, I think we all borrow from other people. Like I, dude, when I designed the Planet Zero tour, there was a couple tours that came out after that where I definitely saw some artists borrowing on the design that me and Mitch did. So, I was like, all right. And it, but honestly, like I've seen artists get upset about it. I saw kind of Tommy Lee get mad about Travis Scott using his thing. Like,
yeah,
to me, it's flattering, dude. Like it took us 6 months to design that Planet Zero tour and the Revolutions Live tour with all the moving lights and the video wall. That was a big monolith that opened up, yeah, and 40 feet tall, and the stage that's in the middle of the crowd, that's all graded and everything's hidden. When I've seen about 4 or 5 bands completely rip that off. And you know what? Like, I don't care. It's flattering to me, man.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Well, look, I mean, Gene Simmons always says there's a little bit of Kiss in every show you see. So,
100. Oh, dude, there's a lot of Kiss in our show. We toured with Kiss, though, in Canada in 2013. That was, yeah,
that was the Monster Tour, I think, was it?
The Monster Tour was our first big Canadian tour that we ever did.
You know what? I saw you on that tour front row in Montreal. Now that you just reminded me, I was there for
that. Yeah, that would also have been July 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At Center Bell, if you will, or whatever it's called.
So, yeah, the Bell Center where the Habs play.
Yeah, the Bell Center.
Go Habs,
yeah,
go.
It was fun, man. That was a good tour. I watched their show every single night. I was like, I never got tired of it. I mean, like 20 something shows. I was out there at front house every single night watching the show. Cause you know, you learn from bands like that. Like you said, like when Gene says that, he's right. There is a little bit of Kiss in most shows. I wouldn't say every show, but most shows.
Yeah. I just went to see Travis Scott a couple of weeks ago and like his show was more rock than the last rock show I saw.
Dude, a couple of our crew guys were out on that, man. And I heard it was crucially loud.
Dude. Well, I think I saw online, I think Pooch is doing his front of house.
Pooch mixes out on the loading dock where the trucks are.
Yeah. I saw that online. I'm like, wait, he's not even in the arena. Dude, we were sitting.
Loud.
No, it was retardedly loud. It was like we were on like the first mezzanine and like it was just the length of the ice was subwoofers on both sides.
Yeah, on both sides. Both sides. 100%. Oh, I got pictures of it that they sent me, the video of what they sent me. It's so wild. I stopped by and saw it. We finished our tour in Denver, and then they kind of pulled in right after us, and I had stayed to go to a football game with my brothers. And I was kind of riding a scooter around there, and I like texted. I was like, I want to come in and see it. And I walked in and saw it. It's crazy, man. That video wall is insane, too.
Yeah. It was like cool jump scares and everything. I mean, like, talking about that, I mean, like, how expensive is it for you guys to tour with all that production and everything? I mean, like, It must be insane.
So stupid. I remember getting the budget for Revolutions Live, and I remember our pretty much almost tripling in price. And not because like we had more trucks, and we did have more trucks, but I mean just per truck. Our trucking and busing, I mean, people don't talk about it. And like I see articles on Blabbermouth and all this stuff, and people talking about touring, and then, you know, people commenting like, oh, you fucking crybaby and all this shit. Like, look, no, man, listen, you got to think that most bands you see that you think are making all this money, the biggest band, doesn't matter, take 70% of that money away off the jump. You've got managers, which are usually 10 to 20%. You've got booking agents, which are always usually 10%. You've got business managers. You've got to pay your crew. You've got to pay for, you know, 7 buses. You've got to pay for 13 trucks. You have to pay for all this stuff. And that's not even before you bring your production in. That's just getting your production around. So it's become wildly expensive to tour. We still do it so much. But yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes like bands, like these bands canceling all these European tours last year, I was like, I get it, man. You can't afford it. Mm-hmm. You can't like, and why go somewhere and just like lose, you know, $350,000? Right. You know, there's just really like, you gotta, and we, dude, the amount of times we've gone on a tour and lost $350,000, I can't count on 2 hands. I mean, like it's happened so much. Now we're obviously in a different spot, But we did that again to build where we are.
Yeah.
You know, we want fans to come to this thing. And now, you know, we go out on tour and we don't necessarily lose money, but we're not, dude, any rock artist who comes on here for the most part is a traveling t-shirt salesman. Mm. That's where you make your money.
Yeah. It's on the merch. Yeah, and you know, 100%. And all the fans would be moaning, like, "Oh, $350 to go see Shine." Oh, fuck that! Like, you know, and then like, "Oh, they're a bunch of greedy. They're greedy. They're this. They're that." Everyone's shitting online, but it's like, but they don't understand the cost associated with the show.
And honestly, like, we try to keep our tickets super low. Like, that's something that we really fight for. So, for you know, you got to sell a lot of tickets if you're going to keep a low ticket price. And luckily, knock on wood, we've done that. But yeah, man, it's a lot. And that's why, you know, the people bitching about the shirt thing is like a $40 shirt, $45 shirt. I'm like, listen, man, the venue's taking 30% of this off the rip. Mm-hmm. Then it costs another $9, $8 to print the shirt. Then I got to pay a manager and I got to pay a businessman. Like, you know, like everyone's making this money before all the bands are, you know. Listen, I'm not complaining, man. We've been very blessed and we've done very, very well for ourselves. And no one's, you know, none of us are wondering where to eat lunch tomorrow or if we're going to have right. the money to. But for people to be like, oh, all these bands are, you know, they've got hundreds of million dollars. That's not the case anymore.
How much does it cost to make something like this?
I believe that's probably about like $7.
Yeah. And then you go to the show.
When you got to print it. Here's the thing. It's $7 if you print 20,000 of them.
Yeah.
It's 20 if you print more than that.
It's a big investment right off the top, hoping you sell those and recoup it.
Yeah.
And then you go to the show, sign them, sell them for $100. Boom. Bob's your uncle.
There you go. I always joke that we've devalued our signature so much at this point. When eBayers, there's like always eBayers outside. I mean, there are two outside the hotel today in New York. And it's like, you know what? I'm like, you're not going to get anything for this, man. I'll sign it.
I used to not sign it. Do you recognize them at this point? You're like, yeah, eBayer.
I mean, you kind of know. No person in their right mind is going to know what hotel you're staying at. Come there, you know. And usually they always have like guards. They've got like five telly pick guards or strat pick guards.
You're like, I don't even play a strat, but okay, also
you got five tellies at home that you just really are dying to have my signature on, man. So I always rib them a little bit, and I'm always like, listen, like give. I don't care what percentage you give of this to St. Jude, but like give a percentage of what you make off this to St. Jude, and they always usually agree. I don't know if they've ever done it or not, but
hell no. No way those guys are giving it.
Probably not.
I was cracking up. I see videos of like Rhea Ripley and like WWE superstars like getting hounded for autographs in airports and stuff. And I'm like, man, it must get annoying.
Oh, it's super. Dude, airport's super annoying. Minneapolis is bad. Philly's bad. Tampa's bad.
Autograph
hounds. Like where they come to a lot of those places. It's kind of wild.
I just wanted to tell you really quickly because I thought you'd find this hilarious because you're super hardcore. My buddy and I were watching you on the thing with Two Heads podcast, and like he's super hardcore. Like Halloween, like every year, like we have marathons, like the whole thing. Like, and yeah. I just had Eric Bloom from Blue Oyster Cult on the show a couple of days ago, and I asked him straight up. I was like, "What do you think was the best usage of Don't Fear the Reaper?" And of course he went right with Halloween, and I thought you would have enjoyed that little tidbit.
So. I love that. That's great. I'm such a diehard, man. I always have been. And, you know, I can't help it.
Yeah.
I'm a big Halloween guy.
Well, I asked him, I was like, do you prefer it in Halloween or in The Stand? And he was like, oh, Halloween for sure. The originator.
Where is it in The Stand?
The Stand. Okay, so you know the scene where like they're all kind of like waking up. They got like the virus sort of thing, and like it's a slow shot, and like Don't Fear the Reaper's playing to the end. It's like super creepy.
Yeah, now I remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My buddy Adam, that's like his favorite one. He's like, that's like the most powerful usage of it.
Yeah, dude. That's pretty sick. I don't know, man. I'm a big Halloween guy, obviously. I was in the last movie, and I've got all the masks, and I'm friends with a lot of the cast, and yeah, I'm a big Halloween guy forever. And like everyone thinks I'd love horror movies, and I really don't.
Yeah.
I'm just like a Halloween guy.
Do you like all of them? Or like, is there a couple that stand out where you're like, nah.
I mean, if you watch that Things with Two Heads thing, you can probably tell which ones I don't. I don't like beating it in the ground. There's some that I don't love.
Yeah. Well, my buddy and I, it's like we love 1, 2, and 3, Resurrection. We love Rob Zombie's, David Gordon Green's. But like, you know, part 4, 5, H2O, Curse of Michael Myers, just meh.
See, I'm a big Curse guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Hold on. I'm going to take my watch off. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
I'm a big Curse guy, man. I love Curse. A lot of people shit on it and don't love it, but I love Curse of Michael Myers. I think, you know why? Because I'm not a big gore guy. So once, okay, even like starting at 2, like the nurse scene with the guy there like laying on the floor and there's blood. I'm like,
yeah.
Like, I don't like seeing gore. Like, to me, my favorite John Carpenter quote, he talks about, and I believe that it was like the 25th anniversary or something, where he says, like, everybody knows what a guy with a knife's going to do. He's like, you don't have to show it.
Yeah.
And I was like, perfect. I mean, you look Halloween 1, which is my favorite movie of all time and probably one of the best scary movie ever. There's no blood. There's blood in one scene where she's got a little bit from her arm where he kind of like barely nicked her. There's like one little stream of blood. That's the only blood in the whole movie.
Yeah. And they didn't overdo it. You didn't have to.
No, I like suspense. That's why I thought the movie Black Phone was really good. I thought that was like, there were so many times. Like, to me, if you can create a moment and be suspenseful and have you like filled with like, ugh, like I love that, man. Like, that's like, I would rather... Yeah, man, I would rather be like, oh my God, is that guy going to wake up? Like, I get like that. Like, any movie, you know, where like someone's snooping around someone's house and they're pulling in the driveway, my anxiety goes off the charts, man.
It's so true, though, because it gets the heart pumping, right?
Yeah, man, for sure.
One last question, because we're running out of time. This is really just like a really odd question, but not really. So a couple of years ago, you guys played a show as a 3-piece and, you know, bass players' tracks were playing. And, of course, that's become sort of like a controversial thing these days. You got Eddie Trunk always bitching and moaning about, you know, oh, bands playing the tracks. It's not rock and roll. But yet,
no, Eddie.
Yeah, I know. But I don't care. Like, I love it. I just had Dean Cashanova from Journey on the show last week and asked him about triggers. I'm like, you know, talk about triggers versus, you know, your live drum sound. He's like, I prefer triggers in stadiums because it gives consistency every night and the fans get a perfect show. And I said that's exactly the idea behind tracks. I mean, like, look, you guys got Greg Rule, Van Halen's guy on tour as your tape guy. I mean,
Eagles too.
Yeah. I mean, does somebody like that, like bring, like elevate it a little bit and say, like, you know, bring his experience from those shows. Like, what does a guy like that bring to the tracks sphere for you?
I mean, honestly, it's funny, man. Like, we've never been this band that's like uses, like, I think because we talk about tracks, I think people think that we are like this band that like uses like all these tracks, and like, that's not true. Like, here's the thing. All these people who like bitch about it, and even Eddie Trunk, like, I agree with certain things they say. If there's like a guitar solo going on and the guy's not soloing, like, dude, that's bullshit. Like, I agree with that. Like, if there's somebody pretending to play the piano, I agree with that. If there's a guy up there just like, and he's not singing, like, I agree with that. We just use it to fill in. Like, we don't want to hire another band member or 2 more band members. So like, yeah, man, I don't want to play xylophone in the 2 seconds that I'm not playing guitar. I don't want to like be holding the keyboard and hold the guitar at the same time. I do it on State of My Head. Dude, there's a song where Eric plays acoustic guitar, piano, bass, and bass with his feet while he's playing acoustic guitar. Dude, if we were going to use that many tracks, as like somebody like that says, like, just put all that shit on track.
Right.
Why make him torture himself by having like bass? Like, he's like Geddy Lee. He's got a piano. He's playing a full grand piano. Then he goes over and plays the acoustic, and he's playing bass with his feet at the same time. I'm like, dude, I would just put all that on tracks.
Right.
Like, why would we not put all that track? So I do. Here's the thing. I think people, I always get quoted, dude, in every Blabbermouth article of being like, well, that's just the way it is now, and blah, blah, blah. And it's just, which I probably should have done a better job of voicing my opinion. Mm-hmm. I agree with the people who bitch about those things.
Right.
If you got a guy up there that's not singing at all and he's just miming, that's bullshit. I 1000% agree with that. But like, if you got like, dude, there are no bands that have like rhythm guitar tracks. We don't really run any guitars. We run like 40 piece orchestras for Second Chance and Crow and the Butterfly and Symptom of Being Human. But like, yeah, I think that there's ways to do it that are great, that you don't want to bring three other people on stage with you and mess up the dynamic of what your band is, you know? And so I definitely think there's a way to do that. But yeah, I don't get mad at these old get off my lawn dudes who are like, oh, well, I don't think it's that way. I'm like, well, listen, man, like the funny thing about Trunk to me is like two of his favorite bands are Def Leppard and Kiss. And I'm like, you don't say shit about them doing it, man. Like, dude, Def Leppard invented tracks. You know what I mean? Like them and Queen, like I can't think of two other bands who did it first. Queen did it. You think Queen did the bridge to Bohemian Rhapsody live? No. They walked off stage. They weren't even on stage when it was happening.
Blacked out stage. You know what I mean?
So like, yeah, they walked off stage. You know, you think when you hear step inside, walk this way, you don't think there's a vocal track going? Shut the fuck up. Or like, come on, man. Like, just shut. Like, here, just let people do it. Like, here's the thing. Again, if you're paying money to go see a show and it's like all on track, dude, I'm with you, man. Like, that's bullshit. Like, that's go see a play. You know what I mean? Like, but like, here's the thing. And I would invite Eddie Trunk to do this. Come to our show, grab a set of in-ears, put them in, and we'll mute the tracks that are rolling, and you won't be able to tell a fucking difference.
Yeah.
Like, here's the thing. I agree that if bands can go on stage and not do it without it, that's a problem.
Right.
Dude, I can't tell you the amount of shows that our tracks have gone down and no one knows. We know, but no one knows. Dude, we finished so many shows where like system shut down. Like, all right, we'll just finish the show.
Yeah. But even that, I mean, with the level of the production you guys got going to, I mean, you got like, you know, show computers running, you know, production and sync with lights and click. And, like,
100%. Yeah. Our click track. And then, look, there are also songs that we play that don't have a click track. Mm-hmm. But yeah, most of the time the thing that the computer's running is the lighting moving and the a bunch of our pyro cues are on that too.
Right.
So it serves multiple purposes. And Greg Rule is just he's such a dude, man. He's such a great guy and has such a great energy. And you know, again, like this guy did the Eagles. I didn't know the Eagles ran tracks. I thought that was just them singing like angels this whole time.
Right.
And I'm like, wait, they run tracks? He's like, yeah. He's like, I mean, they still do everything. They're up there. He's like, he said, this is a quote. He's like, it's like you guys, you're still up there playing everything. He's like, but there's a little help in there. And I'm like, all right, yeah, that's fair.
I mean, look, what the Van Halen tour did, he pushed play for the keyboards, but it was all Ed.
It was all Ed. Ed's still doing everything. That's like saying like, yeah, dude, Van Halen ran tracks all the time. It's like being like, oh, like Ed can't do this. Bullshit. Ed can do anything better than any of you. So,
yeah.
I mean, that guy was such a master, man. So ridiculous at what he did. There was, you know, you couldn't beat him.
No.
He was such, dude, such an innovator, man. Like, it bums me out to talk about it. He was so good. And I'm so bummed that he's not here to still make music and watch his son, who's incredibly amazing, also make music, you know?
Well, how big of an influence was he on your playing?
Not a lot of my playing, because I can't play that way, and I'm not
right.
Stupid enough to think that I can.
You're not busting out Eruption in the middle of your solo?
No, I can't. That's not me, man. I B.B. King taught me how to play more, but as far as songwriting goes, mm-hmm. a huge influence. The guy was one of the best songwriters. Underrated as a songwriter too, man. Like, yeah, like, and I'm a Sammy Van Halen guy. Like, that's just
me
where
too.
I'm at. That's where the songs were.
Yep.
Like, listen,
top of the world. Come on.
Yeah, dude. Any of that stuff, man. Like, finish what you start. Like, dude, all right now is one of the greatest songs ever written. And that's Ed, man. Do you think about that? Dude, here's the thing. You can sing those lyrics, which are amazing, all you want. But if you don't have that piano part that, dude, I literally have chills all over my body right now talking about that piano part. If you don't have that piano part that Ed wrote, making you feel like you can run through a fucking brick wall, those words don't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was the combination of Sammy and Ed that like did it. You know what I mean? And that's the thing is like, so as a guitar player, not a huge influence just because I'm not stupid enough to think I could ever play guitar like that. But as a songwriter, Eddie Van Halen, I mean, up there with anybody as far as rock songwriting to me.
Yeah. I agree.
Maybe as far as rock songwriting, number one, probably.
Easily. I mean, dude, just in right now, you hear that B flat note just bound. Oh, dude, when my that, God. Bro,
when the bass note comes in on that piano, you're like, I could jump over this fucking building right now. Like, 100%.
Yep, totally. Dude,
he's looked at as this guitar god, which he should be, because here's the thing about guitar players, man. There's many guitar players that can play faster than Eddie Van Halen now, mm-hmm. but they didn't invent it.
Nope.
He invented it. And guess what? If you try to sound like Eddie Van Halen, fuck you. There's no way, dude. There's no way you can do it. He was just, people throw around the word genius a lot, and they do it very misleadingly. Dude, Eddie Van Halen was a genius. A Albert Einstein of composition. Yep. Like, there's no other way to put it.
But even with what he did with gear, I mean, like, you look at the timing, nobody was doing wet, making dry, wet setups.
And shit.
Yeah, seriously. But I mean, like, you know, potting his own pickups and, like, you know, being one of the first guys with a Floyd and, like, the wet, dry, wet setups and the Bradshaw rigs and, you know.
Dude, if I go up right now, and I did play through Eddie's rig.
Did
and
you?
Guess what I sounded like? Zach Myers playing on Eddie Van Halen's guitar rig. I did not sound like fucking Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Here's the difference between great guitar players and guitar players who can play guitar. Great guitar players. Eddie Van Halen could go right now to my rig, which sounds nothing like a Van Halen song or any sort of thing, and he's going to sound like Eddie Van Halen. Period. He ain't going to sound like me. He ain't going to sound like Eddie Van Halen through my guitar rig, which is what I sounded like through his guitar rig. But I'm not a great guitar player. I'm a good guitar player who knows how to write songs. And the biggest lesson I ever learned, which is from B.B. King, is like, know when not to play. Mm. And that's what I do. I'm not trying to fill up all this space, man. Like, I've got a great bass player. Like, I got one of those solid drummers in rock music who gets so overlooked. The dude is literally John Bonham, man. Like, he's so steady. And like, I got to use that and go, I know when to create space and when not to play. But yeah, that's the difference between great guitar players. Eddie was a great guitar player. He's maybe the greatest guitar player, but you know, it's just like that again, when you can, Eric Johnson's like that. I was playing through this amp one time. I've told the story a million times, but I was playing through this amp one time at the Dallas Guitar Show, 96 or 7. And it was this amp company called Kendrick, and they put a 10 and a 12 in an amp to see what it was like. And it did not sound good when I was playing it. Mm. And I left my jacket in there. And I walked around the guitar show a little bit more, and I went back in to get my jacket. And I hear this amp, and it sounds incredible. And I'm like, and then I go in and get my jacket, and it's Eric Johnson playing guitar, cable, amp.
Yeah.
Not one pedal. And he sounds like Eric Johnson. It sounds like there's delays and overdrives.
Jeez.
It's just great guitar players, man. Eddie was a great guitar. And I think the word great guitar player gets overused. Yeah. I think there's dudes who can play guitar. I always tell people all the time, they go, you a golfer? I'm like, I play golf.
Yeah.
Not a golfer.
Yeah. It's like a NASCAR driver. No, I just drive cars.
Yeah, yeah. Like, no, NASCAR drivers are NASCAR drivers. You know what I mean? It's like, that's the thing. It's like, anybody's like, well, I drive a car too. It's like, yeah, but you're not that. It takes a level to be that. And honestly, man, I don't know. To me, there's 20 great guitar players.
Yeah.
Great. Great. And take them out of their computer chair off YouTube with their little cool podcast lights and put them on any amp in the world. And can you still do that?
Absolutely.
That's a great guitar player. And that's what Eddie Van Halen was.
Yeah. If you could take one of those guitar players, put them up at Smoke Meat Pete's on a blues night, see if they could solo over some local band. Yeah. Then we could talk.
And bend a note. Don't just do this shit.
Yeah.
Bend and be like, you know, dude, B.B. King made me leave the stage one time by hitting one note. He held one note for 12 bars, and I put my guitar down and I walked off the stage. I was like, okay.
Yep.
You can't beat that.
No.
And it was like a lesson, because it was me and it was Kenny Wayne, and we're doing this thing, and like, everyone gets to go. And then he looks at the drummer, and the drummer stops, and he just holds this one note and just wiggles it.
That vibrato, like, he had, man.
The best vibrato of any guitar player ever. I'll fight anyone who thinks otherwise.
Yeah. Well, it's like Eddie Van Halen always said, you know, it's about whether you know how to make it talk. You could have any guitar in the world, but if you don't know how to make it talk.
100%. And he does. He's the best, man.
Yeah. Well, look, geez, we went longer than we were supposed to, but this is super fun.
That's all right.
Shinedown. Make sure go check them out. Of course, you got the tour kicking off later on in the summertime. Lots of tour dates. And, of course, a symptom of being human blowing up on radio again, which is freaking awesome. So,
yeah.
Hey, by the way, real quick, is your guitar rig, I know you're running Fractals, talking about the tracks and playback, are you getting like patch changes and everything like dialed into your grid like live too, or are you doing patch changes live?
No, a lot of my changes are dialed into the click.
Yeah.
And then all the ones that don't have a click, I do just with my, I have the slave board out there. So like, I can do it with that, the backup board. And then, and then all the expression stuff I do.
Okay.
So whammy, wah, volume, all that stuff I do. I've seen people build that stuff in. But man, we play so differently every night. Like it's a feel thing to me.
Right.
You know, and honestly, like Drew does the whammy on enemies so I can kind of like run around and like Drew can feel it out. Well, I've tried to build it in and it just doesn't work. But yeah, and then I use the Fractal for clean and for stomps. I use the Fryettes for dirty. All my main sound is a tube head.
Oh, okay. Oh, so it is a tube head.
Yeah.
Nice.
100%.
Yeah, the first time I saw anybody programming in like wah swells and stuff like that was Corey Cherko and Shania Twain's band. He was telling me that literally every wah swell, every volume swell, it's all like programmed within the Helix in the playback rig. And I'm like, oh, it's kind of soulless, but kind of cool at the same time.
Oh, dude, if I could do it and make it work again, I try to do enemies like that.
Mm-hmm.
I try to, but like it just like. We're kind of like, we'll play behind, we'll play ahead. We kind of sway every night with how we're playing. So like, it'd be like in a weird spot. So it just feels better to do it with your foot to me.
You're telling me you're not guitar syncing. You're not miming. You're doing it live.
Well, I'm doing it all. I'm doing it live.
That's awesome. Well, appreciate you taking some time, man. I got to come out to a show and see you guys again this summer.
For sure, man. We'll be around you, I believe, next year. So
yeah, looking forward to that. Thanks a lot for chatting. Appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot, bro.
The Jeremy White Show.
Get exclusive interviews and bonus content on demand now. Visit youtube.com/Jeremy White Show.